This is the Hidden Wire Podcast, episode 586 with Josh Corder. The search for a lasting identity is a stressful waste of time. It's disappointing to keep looking for something that doesn't exist. That is a quote by Josh Corder. Enjoy. G'day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Hidden Wire Podcast. Great to have you here with me today. My name is Lee Martinuzzi, and I am the host of the show. It is awesome. Awesome, guys. Today, I've got a long-form interview to bring you. A guest today is Josh Corder. So if you haven't heard of Josh, he is the presiding founder and, I believe, teacher at Dumb Punks New York City. So he's done this for over the last decade. In this interview, guys, Josh shares his spiritual journey to sobriety. As a punk rocker with an interesting upbringing, Josh found himself on a journey through alcohol and drug addiction. And he was definitely exposed to a lot of Buddhist practice and insight throughout his upbringing. And I believe it was that spiritual insight that allowed him to overcome the challenges of life. He is the author of Unsubscribe from Delusion and Tune Into Truth. And in this episode, that's what he assists us to do, is to unsubscribe from the delusion of our life, to help battle the addictions, the challenges that we may have. And he shares some really cool insights and ideas throughout this conversation that I think you'll enjoy as well. I certainly did. Guys, if you love it, let me know what you think. Jump onto thehiddenwire.com, leave your thoughts in the comments field, and reach out to me. I would love to, I'd love to hear from you and chat with you further. Guys, enjoy this interview with Josh Corder. Cheers. G'day, Josh. Welcome to the Hidden Wire Podcast. How are you today?
Well, it's a rainy, gray, overcast day in Brooklyn, New York, and about 62 degrees. Don't know what that is in Celsius, but kind of like your standard rainy spring day. So it's a good day to sit inside and have a nice conversation.
Sounds beautiful. What time of the day is it there?
It is 4 in the afternoon. What time is it where you are?
It is 6 in the morning.
Oh, my goodness. You're much more of a morning person than I am. I'm 6 in the morning. I'm either unconscious or there's something very wrong.
It's weird. At the moment, I'm sort of waking up quite early. Like, I must have been... And then bright, you know, not like waking up and struggling, but just actually very alert. And this morning, I reckon it must have been about 4 o'clock or a little bit before, maybe 3:30, which doesn't always happen. But recently, it's been happening pretty regularly. So not sure what's causing that. But I'm going to bed early as well, so I'm an early to bed, early to rise sort of guy.
Yeah, I've never really quite cottoned on to that schedule from my earliest. Punk rock years, I've always had a kind of a night owl type schedule, so I'm quite the opposite. If I'm lucky, I fall asleep at around 1 in the morning and wake up at around 9.
Okay, so it's just that routine that you got yourself into in the early years?
Yep, exactly. Never stopped.
So you're a bit of a punk rocker. Tell us your story there. What was your upbringing like?
Well, I grew up in New York, 57. I grew up near, well, the way Upper West Side, near the sort of the delineation of where Harlem begins. And my father was a alcoholic Buddhist Zen practitioner artist. My mom was a writer and heavily into psychology. So when I grew up on the bookshelves, there was both books by just a whole mini library of psychology books and Buddhist books.
That's kind of fascinating, just on that. Like, your dad was an alcoholic, but a Buddhist practitioner.
Wasn't that unusual in those days? In America, the beat poets in the 50s were heavily in both alcohol and Zen Buddhism. A lot of famous Buddhist teachers, Trungpa Rinpoche, Alan Watts, were alcoholics. Mm. So there wasn't quite that emphasis on aside intoxicants that there is today, there was also in Buddhist circles a lot of casual drug use as well. So it was in no way incompatible at the time.
What are your thoughts on that today?
Well, I've been sober for almost 25 years, so but it's difficult to separate my thoughts from obviously my own life from my own views. The Buddha was pretty straightforward in calling for putting aside intoxicants. Some Buddhists interpret that as just not getting intoxicated, so you can drink or use a substance so long as it doesn't cause a significant degree of inebriation. Right. Other Buddhists interpret it as a more stricter renunciation of mood-altering substances. Hmm. In my case, the decision was made for me. It's pretty clear from, just like my dad's life, I don't use or consume alcohol in any sort of social or refined manner. For me, it just triggers a response to seek more.
So you've chosen total sobriety then?
Oh, yeah. I stopped, I think January 1995. And that really coincided with my doubling down on my Buddhist practice. I'd always been, from early on, I had studied the Dharma and I had integrated Buddhist insights into high school papers and college papers, and I had pretty much inherited my dad's Buddhist library and bought my own and would sit in Buddhist centers. But when I got sober, it was pretty clear that I needed to have a spiritual path to support that. So that's when really I started focusing heavily on more diligently, not only on community membership and deepening my daily practice and studying with teachers and so forth. Now, in terms of punk rock, growing up in New York in the 70s was, pretty much it was all around, along with London, New York was pretty much the ground zero for punk rock as well as for rap. Yeah. And all around you, there'd be suddenly, I didn't, at the time I moved down to Union Square, so I lived pretty close to the CBGBs. It was very easy to go or walk a few blocks and to see shows with bands that are now legendary, but at the time they were just like your local bar band. Like, you could walk over and see, Talking Heads, Television, Ramones were there.
Sounds cool.
Yeah, there was. It was.
I couldn't imagine the scene, the scenery, that era.
Well, it was pretty. New York was pretty decrepit. It was bankrupt. Essentially, there was unimaginable degrees of crime. Mm. At the time, there were areas of the city was burning down. Landlords were essentially torching their properties for insurance. There was at the time, there was a lot of flight away from urban centers into the suburbs. So it felt pretty much like a wasteland from the mid to late 70s through the late 80s, the beginnings of gentrification and the sort of return of wealth into the city started around the 90s in the Lower East Side and stuff like that. But it was quite an interesting environment to grow up in, to say the least.
So how do you think that influenced your life?
The
Just that sort of upbringing, like you going from, you know, with your parents, growing up with those parents, but then also your teenage years living in that area and into your early adulthood.
I think that probably, just by nature, being attracted to the kind of music and counterculture I was, being a young sort of stoner. First, when I was in my teens, I loved bands like Black Sabbath, and pretty soon that turned into more traditionally punk, and then hardcore bands. But there was a very DIY attitude at the time, which was, you know, do it yourself, not rely on any there wasn't really any institutions to support young people. So we had to pretty much form collectives and put on our own shows and find our own warehouses to have gigs and to do political activism. It was pretty guerrilla style, you know, just making posters to protest American foreign policy and stuff like that. It was definitely a feeling of living on the edges and are on a sort of an outpost of civilization, even though it was in New York. Yeah. And that sort of definitely has affected my approach to eventually being with Noah and Vinny and some other people, the founders of the sort of Dharma punks movement, and the trying to bring a new, entirely outsider approach to Buddhist practice, and all the things that I've done. Yeah, pretty much it's all been informed by that upbringing.
Okay. And I mean, you talk about, you know, going through drug addiction yourself and alcohol addiction as well, I believe. Just talk to us through that. I mean, is that coming through that scene? That's where it sort of began and spiraled out of control. What was that all like?
Sorry, by the way, you might have heard a crashing sound in the background. That's my cat pushing over. Yeah, there's a few of them, and they're all cheeky. So in terms of my drinking and addictive tendencies, I mean, my dad, when you grow up with an alcoholic, and my dad for the earlier years of my life was pretty violent, macho guy. And so there wasn't a lot of secure family system for a significant period. So when that's the case, as a child, you don't really have a sense of a parent, what at least one of my parents being available in any meaningful way to help me process life or work with difficult emotions. So when you don't have that,
it's huge. Yeah.
Yeah, you then look for other ways to process or regulate your emotions, especially the emotions that your parents didn't handle too well. So in my case, my mom was much more secure and much more available, but she was also terrorized by my father. So my dad didn't like... in men, he didn't like any kind of fear or, you know, there were certain emotions that he thought were, for whatever reason, he didn't seem to be very patient with. So when you don't have somebody helping you process natural human affects or feelings, then when those feelings appear in life, you will probably look for a substance to help you regulate those feelings rather than disclose them to other people, because early on in life you've been informed that sadness or fear or disappointment or loneliness is not acceptable to other people.
Yeah. So you look for ways to numb those emotions.
Exactly. Or at least, if not numb them, to to auto-regulate them, which means human beings are co-regulating. We need each other. We're a social species with social brains to assess our emotional experience. That's what emotion co-regulation is. It's when we feel any strong emotion, we need to find someone who's empathetic, express what's happened to us, and then through their facial expressions and their tone of voice and their eye contact and their presence, we develop what's called limbic regulation, which means our heartbeats and our slow and our nervous system, the sympathetic nervous system, slowly deactivates. And so we calm down.
Yeah.
But if you don't have somebody to help you calm down when you're young for certain emotions or certain experiences or certain impulses, then you'll look for substances to do that work for you. Hmm. And unfortunately, it doesn't really work because emotions are not meant to go away simply because you've repressed them with a substance. They simply get repressed for a little while and then they come back in an even more dysregulated form.
Gotcha. So, and did you reflect on that in relation to your father's life as well? Obviously, with you, you know, having the support you needed, you sort of looked for ways to bring calmness to those emotions that you were feeling. But your dad as well, do you reflect on that often and how, you know, how he was handling his emotions and why that caused him to be the way he was?
Well, actually, what happened was, my sister and I, when my dad was in his probably late 60s, my sister and I, when we were in our 30s, we basically both set boundaries with him that we weren't going to have a relationship with him unless he went into family therapy with us. Hmm. So we found a Buddhist therapist, and we would all sit together and talk. And so actually, I actually got to hear from him. I'd already been familiar with a lot of his own abusive upbringing, but a lot became clearer in family therapy as we, you know, sat around and expressed our own feelings and what was triggering us and learned how to set boundaries with each other and so forth.
Yeah, yeah. So with your, you know, your own... Because I suppose a lot of people can relate to that, you know, drug and alcohol addiction and that need to bring some calmness or escape to that part of their life. The spiritual path out of there, do you believe that was what sort of took you away? I mean, is that the only thing? Were there other elements to getting you on the path to sobriety, I suppose?
Oh, sure. I mean, in America, it was 12-step land. I mean... not far from where I live, AA was created a lot, you know, decades before I got sober. In the 1930s, Bill Wilson started AA and 12-step sobriety in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And so in where in New York, there's meetings, there's 12-step meetings everywhere.
Yeah.
And so,
you're a part of the 12-step program?
Oh, sure. I was definitely, I mean, strictly speaking, we're not supposed to break our anonymity, but at this point, my sobriety is now pretty much maintained through my Buddhist communities and teaching and practice and support.
Yeah.
But yes, I definitely... when I first got sober, took advantage of everything that was available. I would definitely recommend it to anyone who is struggling with drugs and alcohol. You know, even though AA is a pretty theistic Christian organization, and I had no interest in any theistic Christian path in my life. My mother was Jewish. My dad was Buddhist. There was no real interest in suddenly converting to that path, but in the slightest. And I've never believed in any God. But
do you think that turns a lot of people away, like that? Just that aspect.
Oh, I know it does. There's lots of studies in the U.S. that show that as many people are attracted to AA, there's many people who are won't come in specifically because of the Judeo-Christian sort of God focused quality. And even though AA in its literature is very clear that you can choose a God of your own understanding, and you can be agnostic, and you don't have to make your higher power anything like a God, but still the literature and almost all of the meetings have this heavily theistic, heavily Judeo-Christian quality to them. So it's unfortunate that it's still a major issue. In the U.S., there's now alternatives to 12-step recovery. There's organizations like Refuge Recovery, which is a Buddhist recovery tradition. And so there's other ways, and certainly people can really – the key to getting sober is not so much the specific tools of any program. It's the being surrounded by other people who are facing some of the same issues, who are disclosing their emotions, and who are creating a safe container so that one can express one's feelings.
So again, it's going back to being able to share the emotions, as we started with, rather than trying to suppress them through addiction.
Exactly. The only way to heal an addiction is to undo. It's called, creating the corrective emotional experience. And there's a lot of wonderful clinical books on the subject, like Addiction is Attachment Disorder, that basically show that the key to addressing addiction and alcoholism is to locate a community where one can essentially begin to disclose the emotions and impulses and memories and experiences that one was taught to repress in childhood. So, it's essentially undoing by finding people who will give you what, the adults in your childhood and early life couldn't give you.
Interesting. Do you feel that part of even the 12-step program, that spiritual aspect is necessary for overcoming addiction? Because I hear it a lot, through people that have faced their own challenges, alcohol and drug addiction, they've found that spiritual path. Is that in your sort of mindset or thoughts the path for most people because of the community that's there?
Well, personally, I think it depends how one defines spiritual. Spiritual is a word that to some people it means religious, and of course that's not the case. Many, many, many untold millions of people get sober without being religious.
Yeah, gotcha.
So it's not that.
How do you define spiritual?
Yeah. I don't define spiritual as theism or God-centered, because there are millions of people who get sober who don't believe in God, who are atheists. So I would define spiritual as those areas and concerns that are non-material. Materialist are things you can touch, they're tangible, that, so a materialist concern is wealth or how much objects you own or stuff like that. A spiritual concern are all those intangibles that give life meaning, such as friendship, volunteerism, altruism, kindness, compassion, empathy, creativity. So they're not things, they're activities that bond us together with others. You can't point to anything. It's just an activity that brings you what bonds you closer in a healthy, productive way with your tribe. And I think that goes back to...
It's fascinating.
Human beings are spiritual in the sense that we are all tribal. The vast bulk of human history was spent in hunter-gatherer collectives. And basically what that meant is we would be in very small groups of about six or seven other adults who we would spend most of our lives with, and they were non-hierarchical. The groups were self-supporting, and each individual, to stay in the group and stay alive, had to be altruistic and pro-tribal and would have to take care of others who were ill, would have to at times cut short their going out hunting for food and resources to take care of the other members. And if you were selfish, if you only looked to hoard food supplies for yourself, the other members of the group, the clan that you were in, would eventually cast you out and you would perish. So deeply embedded in we have hardwired tribal circuits that create feelings of shame and guilt and remorse when we act in a antisocial way. And we have positive emotions like pride and esteem and joy that reward us for connecting with others. And there's a whole wonderful neuropsychologists like Matthew Lieberman, Naomi Eisenberg, John Cacioppo, et cetera, that really focus on locating the areas in the brain, like the anterior cingulate cortex, where the social circuits are housed. And so, yeah, that's why I think we are spiritual beings, because we are beings that have survived as a species simply due to our ability to connect with each other.
Yeah, absolutely. That whole connection piece and the relationships being, you know, such a fundamental part of the human condition is something that I certainly relate to. But there's, as you said, and that's a really interesting way to define, you know, the spirituality, I suppose, is those intangible facets that are fundamental to this human experience and to giving us a greater sense of meaning, purpose in life, perhaps. So I've got a couple of questions from all what you've just said there. Perhaps the first one I'll just run with it is, you know, in regards to those ideas of, you know, the need for connection, the need for belongingness. Do you feel that that's something that's coming back? Because I sort of feel that perhaps we lost it. We started to focus on all the tangible aspects of our life that gave us meaning, and through that chaos, you know, there was a lot of disconnect and a lot of emotions that weren't being dealt with, and perhaps that's why we are where we are now.
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly by far not the first to note that our growing dependence on asynchronous communication channels such as posting on social media, texting, emails, and all the other Twitter and all the other ways that people communicate today, because they remove the interpersonal face-to-face contact, human beings are meant to communicate face-to-face in proximity. The reason why we have two hemispheres in our brain is that one hemisphere, the right, is in the background of consciousness processing each other's facial expressions, body language, tone of voice, eye contact, body movements, and everything that, you know, we're processing all this stuff in the semi-unconsciously, and it creates feelings of ease and comfort and security when we feel that we are connected with someone. And if we're simply trying to get our interpersonal needs met by posting something into a void, there's that. All the nonverbal necessary components are lost, and we only need to read, you know, some of the most important works of Alan Shore, whose massive works on affect regulation show demonstratively that without interpersonal direct, you know, co-regulation via being in the same room and expressing emotions, disclosing emotions with each other in real time, that what happens is progressively various emotions become suppressed and we become increasingly dysregulated. People on Facebook, for example, only show images of themselves being happy, you know.
Yeah.
You know, doing something exciting. Nobody shows images of themselves sad, lonely, frustrated, despairing. And so increasingly those emotions get bifurcated from our lives. They become unexpressed. And over time we lose the ability, even when we're actually around people, to meaningfully reveal for processing all these feelings, so they become increasingly, you know, painful. And so hopefully there'll be a rebound in our culture which will prioritize interpersonal exchange. In the U.S. it's kind of especially sad because there's less funding for public spaces. There's, you know, pretty much the town halls or the social gathering spaces are increasingly more remote and extinct. People become more and more exhausted from stressful work, and so they come home and consume or attempt to consume their interpersonal needs through, you know, turning on Netflix or
reality TV.
Yeah, exactly. So, yes, I would certainly like to believe that that will that there'll be, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I sort of feel that it is. I mean, you look at, you know, people like yourself doing the work that you do is certainly creating that space and, you know, creating that, I guess, connection back to these intangible qualities of life. And there's definitely more of that happening, more books about it, et cetera, more sharing. And I think that's where the global community and online digital tech can actually help us too. You know, it's not necessarily an evil tool. Used in the right way, it can probably actually really bring some greater benefits longer term.
Yeah, it's definitely not evil. I don't mean to imply that. I do mean, though, that when it's over relied upon,
yeah,
it's and unfortunately it is presently over relied upon. If you go to any sort of public space that remains in New York and you look around at people, they're not engaged in very often they're stuck staring at their iPhones, which is again a kind of obviously it's addictive. When you look at a phone, you get a jolt of dopamine that you don't necessarily when you're taking the vulnerable risk of reaching out and trying to connect with somebody you don't know very well.
It's interesting, isn't it? Very interesting. And I read the other day, or heard the other day, that recent studies suggest that we're on the phone for 5 hours a day, or the average person is anyway.
Yeah, and they find for every hour you're on the phone, it's a half hour less that you would be talking to another human being. Mm. So that's 2.5 hours per day less interpersonal, you know, connection. So
crazy, isn't it?
Crazy is a word for it, I suppose.
So look, I want to jump into more on that and perhaps some of the things that you teach as well. But I just want to go back to the addiction part, drug and alcohol addiction. Do you think there's a place for drugs and alcohol in our society? I mean, it always seems to have been around and perhaps we've just abused it, but I sort of feel that tribes going way back did have that aspect too, of people abusing it, and if they did, they were punished for it. But what are your thoughts on drug use?
I can't say that off the top of my head I'm familiar with the, you know, anthropology of addiction in terms of how long there's been dysregulated use of substance to as a way to try to suppress antisocial or difficult emotions. But I know that certainly there's a lot of evidence that shows that it goes back well over 10,000 years in human history, creating, you know, mood altering substances. So I'm sure it's been a while, around for a while.
Are they your cats going in the background?
Yes, that is. I'm going to let her out because she is.
That must sound like a little dog barking.
Yeah, she's. I closed the door to keep the sound out while we were having our conversation, and so she got trapped in the room and is now protesting. But she's been
released, freed. interesting stuff. So you recently launched a book called Unsubscribe: Opt Out of Delusion, Tune Into Truth. And I'd just like to sort of go into that book first of all. So congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, well done. Is it going well?
You know, I honestly have made a pact with my publisher not to ask and not to be informed, because I realize that when you work for as long and as arduously as a book requires, if you then ask, how's it doing? No matter what they tell you, it's going to be emotionally unsatisfying, or, you know, it'll just be a number that they, you know, oh, 2,000 or 5,000 or 8,000 people. But that number doesn't really have any emotional significance at all.
Yeah.
So I honestly don't know. I assume it's done well. At least the reviews have been terrific. But
yeah, it looks like it's doing well from my stance anyway.
But I'm happily living completely in the dark, and that way I don't have any sort of concrete numbers to fixate on.
It's a good way to go. So I suppose what spurred you to write the book, and what could the readers expect from reading it to take away or to benefit?
Well, bringing it all the way back to our initial or sort of the themes that we've been covering. In the U.S., certainly, there's this association with Buddhism and with meditation. There's a sense that meditation is the absolute center of spiritual practice. Mm. And in the U.S., there's a great emphasis upon mindfulness, and we have wonderful teachers that go into big corporations and to prisons and to other institutions to teach people how to meditate. And people get this idea that to be a Buddhist or to be a spiritual person is to meditate. Well, meditation is obviously, it's a inherently an internal practice where one essentially reconnects with one's internal experience.
Yeah.
Generally here, done with the eyes closed, very often done alone, or if you do it in a center with other people, still everybody's quiet and focused internally. And so what I really wanted to do was address this idea that meditation was the epicenter of Buddhist practice. It's in fact only a small fraction of what the Buddha called for. And in fact, if anything, the Buddha was a revolutionary in his time, not because he meditated. That was already well present in Hindu practice before the Buddha, and the Jains meditated. What the Buddha brought to the table was a radical democratization. He allowed all the different castes into his communities, and he really focused on forming communities of people that would essentially even drop out of their work and build or create alternative communities, spaces where people could safely congregate and interact. And at center, the bulk of the Buddha's teachings was about how to interact with each other in a safe way. And the Buddha, when he was asked what was the core of the spiritual path, he didn't say meditation. He said wise spiritual friendships.
Yeah.
It's called the half sutta and other suttas. When the Buddha's asked what's the prerequisite for a spiritual life, he doesn't say meditate. He says find wise spiritual friends, Kalyanamita and Pali. So now, this is not to say that the Buddha was by any means against meditation. It was one of the meditation is two of, out of the Eightfold Path. But the bulk of the factors and the bulk of the Buddha's teachings are about connecting and supporting each other in a healthy way that allows us to grow and feel that there's a secure base in our lives and allows us to take risks and embrace life and be creative because we know we have the support to help us process and work through our experience.
That's really interesting. And what, so in the book, obviously you share a lot of that.
I actually talk about Buddhist practice in terms of three qualities. Only one of the three is meditation. The first is about, reprioritizing life in terms of reflecting on our own mortality and from an existential perspective, what is important for our lives? What gives our lives meaning? Most people, understandably, perhaps don't like to reflect on their own mortality, their own fragility. But when you don't do that, then you don't actually make authentic choices in life. If we make choices without considering the dwindling amount of time we have alive, then we're essentially making choices from a delusional perspective because we're sort of making each choice as if we have unlimited amounts of time. As Heidegger and the existentialists said, the only way any choice in some way reflective of our own finiteness, our own mortality. And so that's one of the concerns in the book. The other is how to make wise spiritual friendships to support us and help us process emotions. Another part of the book is about attachment and the early life experiences that create our attachment styles and how to go about addressing those attachment styles. And then meditation is another part of the book that talks about working with the, you know, emotions that have been repressed and how to reconnect them.
Okay. So after reading the book, you know, certainly the reader could expect to be more set up to, I guess, connect within, to reprioritize their life, find out what's important, and then have those tools available so they can be guided along that path.
Yeah, well, that's the goal. I mean, yeah. If I even get close to that, I'd be, you know, thrilled. But that was the impetus to almost all the Buddhist books I, you know, have read, and I own a small library of them, but they're all pretty much still narrowly focused around meditation and some basic Buddhist themes. So I wanted to really try to broaden Buddhist practice to incorporate a lot of contemporary therapeutic modalities and to also try to deliver to people other tools outside of meditation to help them hopefully grow and live fulfilling lives.
Yeah, and I think, you know, certainly anything you can read that's going to help, it's going to take, you know, a lot of education, and perhaps your book is form part of that to help them along that path. I don't know anyone that could probably just read one book and let it be and suddenly find that awakening, I suppose, if you call it that.
Absolutely.
I'm interested in the whole idea of reprioritizing. I mean, that's really for me, you know, finding your purpose and reconnecting with what's important to you. And that's, again, a process in itself. It's taken me a long time, and it's still going. I don't know if it ever ends necessarily, but it's about constantly connecting with that. And certainly for me, one way to do that is through meditation, to reflect inwardly and allow that silence to really, you know, just think and I guess unplug from all the chaos and busyness of our day-to-day lives. What sort of practices, tools do you suggest there to, you know, connect with that?
One of the reasons why meditation can be so useful is that most of our adult waking hours, we're left hemispheric, and left hemisphere is not only the hemisphere that has the bulk of language and conceptual skills and thinks schematically and represents the world in symbols and maps and so forth. Whereas the right hemisphere is not only about finding security, but it's also, it's the hemisphere that organizes our emotions, and it's timeless. And all of the most basic human concerns, connection with the world around us, connection with others, secure attachment, is overseen by the right brain. Mm. And in meditative practice, what we're hoping to do is to develop a really meaningful bilateral hemispheric state where we're not just overriding or pushing away the needs of the right brain by just living in our thoughts and our plans and our goals and our worries. We actually can pay attention to all the messages that the right brain prioritizes. And the right brain's priorities are very different from the left brain. The left brain is, you know, a great book on this is called The Master's Emissary by Ian McGilchrist, who's a great neuropsychologist. And he basically talks about the different priorities of each of the brain's hemispheres and how that due to contemporary culture, we're far more left hemispheric, and the left hemisphere tries to solve life by financial security, reputation, accumulating awards, successes. It's a very materialist realm. So, the right brain is far more about right now. What can I embrace? Where am I securely connected with other people? What is my relationship with the world and nature around me? And so hopefully in meditation, by connecting with the body and nonverbal experience, we can have a different perspective on our lives.
Mm. Yeah, I like that idea of bilateral. What do you call it? Bilateral. You had a word for it there, but connecting. Integration.
Yeah, well, you could say bilateral integration, and that you're integrating both right and left. Yeah,
I like that. Look, it sounds like a fascinating read. I want to encourage you guys to pick up a copy. I'll stick a link in the show notes as well. That book you just mentioned, The Master
and His Emissary by Ian McGilchrist.
There you go, guys. I'll stick that in the show notes as well. Josh, look, it's been a fantastic conversation. I feel we could talk for hours, to be honest, and I would love to. I've got some quick round questions that I go through with all guests. So I just want to jump into them, and I'm conscious of the time and holding you up as well. So let's go through these questions. And the first one I want to ask you is, do you have any particular routines or rituals that you believe contribute to your success?
Well, I don't know if I'm successful, but I meditate every day. I exercise pretty much every day with the exception of today. I had an off day. I try to be creative every day, do something, you know, that's I take time to sit and play the piano or I try to read every night for at least an hour. Generally, the books I read are I'm deeply steeped in psychology and neuroscience books, but something that brings new ideas, new perspectives. So those are some of the – and also every day I try to connect authentically with at least three different people, if that's possible.
Okay. And what? How would you define success just on that?
You know, I don't know. I suppose success would be the ability to express one's own authentic core feelings, emotional states to another, and to find people that are secure and empathetic enough to hear our experience, and then to be willing to do the same for others, so that we not only develop true bonds, but we help each other stay sane.
What advice would you give your 20-year-old self?
What advice would I give my 20-year-old self? I would say you don't need to keep drinking and taking drugs as long as you did. I probably, by the age of 20, could have, because I'd already been to rehab and detox, I could have probably stopped then. So I probably would have urged myself to have gotten sober a good 13 years earlier than I finally wound up doing so.
Interesting. What's one tool, skill, resource, technique do you believe has helped you improve your effectiveness or productivity in life?
Self-compassion. I don't ever judge, scold, or shame myself. When I was writing my book, I don't set hard tasks or expectations. I tend to, no matter how little or how much creative work I do, I tend to reward myself with acknowledgement and recognition. And so I believe in positive reinforcement only.
Important point. And someone looking to make some change in their life, or a change in their life, what advice would you give them?
Connect with other people who have made the changes in their lives that you believe are healthy and vital, so that you'll get the support, the modeling, and the peership and twinship that would allow you to do the same.
That's really important. Great one. If I've got a few other interesting questions here now, but if you were to be served your last meal, what would you request?
Oh, I don't know. What would I?
I've stumped him.
We have in the U.S. now this, I don't want to advertise anything, but we have these new alternative non-meat burgers that are made from plant proteins that I haven't eaten meat in 40 years, but these are finally, after 40 years, they've developed these new veggie burgers. Nice. That actually taste unbelievably delicious. So I've been actually enjoying finally being able to eat something that
That's amazing. That's the what is it, the Impossible Meats, or
yeah, exactly, Impossible, the Beyond Burgers, the Impossible Burgers and the Beyond Burgers. They are delicious. You know, when I was in the 80s and 90s being a vegetarian in the U.S., pardon my language, but sucked. It was just, it was really difficult. So it's getting easier and easier and easier. Now there's vegan restaurants everywhere. But
That's a good one. I like that. What activity gives you the greatest sense of joy?
Oh, there's so many. We have Russian baths here that are wonderful. I love exercising and going for a cheap massage in Chinatown. Yeah. That feels pretty darn good. I love after a long day of working, spiritual counseling with people. I love meditating and then relaxing, pretty much everything. My life's pretty good.
I like the idea of a Russian bath. I lived in Japan, so I had the Japanese bath or the onsen.
Amazing.
Couldn't get enough of it. I miss it dearly.
Thai massages. When I was in Thailand, you can get a massage there for like $6. And
yeah, they're pretty good.
I'd lie on the beach next to my wife and just get an hour-long massage, and just that felt pretty heavenly.
Pretty amazing. What book would you pass down to your children or a future generation? What one book would you pick? One book.
Ah.
You mentioned one already, which is good. I want another one.
Well, I would say there's a wonderful book by a Buddhist psychologist, Tara Brach, called Radical Acceptance. And I think if a lot of people read that book, they'd be a lot happier in life. It's a wonderful guide for using meditation and spiritual practice as a way to heal early emotional wounds. Her work is has a great deal of overlap with my own, and I really respect her writing. So, Radical Acceptance by Tara Brach, I'd say.
Tara Brach. Cool. Guys, I'll stick that in the show notes. If you would like to support the show, you can use the links through Amazon there, and that does help support the show here. A few more final questions, Josh, I'll let you go. The first one is, do you believe we all have a hidden why or a purpose?
Do we have a hidden why? Purpose?
Yeah, or a purpose.
Why? I tend to be a little bit more existentialist. I tend to believe that unlike the idea that we're born or that we have something predetermined, that's the authentic life is where we uncover through our own actions, our own hidden why. So that it's not assigned. It's through our own actions, our own choices we make that that hidden purpose is produced. It's not preset in us. It's something that we actually, by where we focus, how we live, how we pay attention to others, how we act, all of that is created.
Yep, I couldn't agree more. And what does living life with passion and purpose mean to you?
Authenticity, which means not overcoming the need to conceal or withhold, being able to connect with the feelings, impulses, emotions that were rejected to socialize and to be lovable in childhood, to overcome avoidance coping and to really express and connect with each other with not only honesty but with a sense of fearlessness, in the sense of not withholding.
Yeah. And the final question is, what do you believe is the underlying motivation behind everything you do?
Everything I do is, I think that there's a reciprocity in all human life. To stay sober and to stay happy, we have to help and connect with others. It's only through that we actually have any sense of positive emotional states, because we are social beings with social brains. If we're not meaningfully interacting with others, then we will not be happy. So in a meaningful way, the underlying motivation is my own sanity and my own happiness, and the only way I can achieve that is by caring about other people's happiness and their own safety.
Yeah, I love it. Mate, so powerful. I loved our conversation today. I really appreciate your time as well. And I just want to encourage guys again to go out there and check you out. Now, you've got a website and a book, obviously, so I'll stick the book in the show notes and the website link. So the website is it the best way to reach you? DharmaPunksNYC.com?
Yeah, and anybody wants to write with, if there's any questions, my email is on that. I I do get a lot of emails, but if it's at all possible, I try to read them all. And if I can, I generally try to find a time to jot out a quick answer. So if anybody found themselves perplexed or stumped, feel free to write.
That's awesome. Josh, thank you very much.
Thanks, Lee.
Guys, check it all out at thehiddenwide.com. All the show notes will be there and the links as well. Reach out to Josh. Thank him for coming on the show. And as he suggested, if you have any questions and would like to write to him, his email address is available there as well. So, guys, thank you for tuning in. And until next time, peace, passion, and purpose. See you soon. Thanks, guys, for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed what you heard. I hope you love what you're hearing. If you like this episode, guys, or any of the episodes that you're listening to here at The Hidden Why, please do me a favor by sharing it. You can share it with your families. You can share it with your loved ones. You can do that by using your favorite social media channels, using the icons on the platform that you're listening to The Hidden Why podcast. Also, guys, if you're a fan of the show, please connect with me. Connect with me at thehiddenwide.com. I love to hear from you. I love to converse with the people that listen to this show to find out what they enjoy, what they don't enjoy, and perhaps if they have any questions or feedback for the show as well. You can stay up to date with all that I'm releasing here, guys. I do a solo show every Monday, a 3-minute thought every Thursday. I do 2 interviews a week on a Wednesday and a Saturday, and a book review every Friday. You can stay up to date with all that by subscribing to my newsletter at thehiddenwhy.com. Just enter your email address there, and also subscribing to the podcast on the platform that you choose to listen to your podcasts. You can also support the show, guys, by using the Amazon links at thehiddenwhy.com. So if you like books, you can get all the books that I review there, and anything else really that you like to purchase through Amazon. So use that link and help support the show. And we've also got a deal with Audible, guys. Audible is a fantastic way to listen to all your favorite books. We've got a deal with them so you can get 2 free books when you subscribe subscribe to a 30-day free trial. So check that out again at thehiddenwhy.com. Guys, that's it from me. You know what to do. Go out there, breathe more passion into every single moment. Do everything with greater purpose, and in doing so, you will discover your hidden why. This is The Hidden Why. My name is Lee Martinuzzi. Until next time, peace, passion, and purpose. See you soon.